Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hello, my wonderful little kinksters. It's me, Kate Lister. Today, we are doing a deep dive into the history of BDSM. And as you may have already guessed, there is a lot of adult content, like a lot of adult content. Sexually explicit descriptions, naughty words, and a whole heap more. So if you're ready for this, I am ready to take you with me.
Everybody to their own liking. I think if they like it, well, have it on.
Then all at once, you can find yourself in a situation where your physical urges fight against your reason.
BDSM. It was around before Mr. Grey, you know. Humans have been into kink and whip and spanking and domination and submission for as long as there have been people and parts of people to give a good spanking to. Today, we are joined betwixt the sheets by three guests, one, two, three, who are going to give us a bit more of an understanding into BDSM. A sadomasochistic historian, a professional dominatrix, and her sub. So if you're ready, I'm ready. Let's dive in.
What do you look for in a man?
Oh, money, of course.
You're supposed to rise when an adult speaks to you.
I make perfect copies of whatever my boss needs by just turning a knob and pushing a button.
Yes, social courtesy does make a difference.
Goodness, what beautiful time. Goodness has nothing to do with it, dearie.
Assume that sex in the olden timey days, when it did happen, was all vanilla, as they say. And do you know what? There's nothing wrong with vanilla, let me tell you. But for as long as there have been people having sex, there have been people that are interested in kinky sex. The term BDSM was first recorded in 1991, and it's a combination of the abbreviations BD for bondage and submission, DS for dominance and submission, and SM for sadism and masochism. Today, I am joined by Peter Tupper, who runs the History of BDSM website and the Twitter account, and who has written a book called A Lover's Pinch, A Cultural History of Sadomasochism. So if there's anyone we need to be talking to about the history of kink, it's Peter. And later, we're going to have the pleasure of being joined by professional dominatrix Miss May and her sub, Frankie, who are going to give us an insight into their relationship and the BDSM scene today. What kind of things are popular, such as humiliation, heavy rubber, corporal punishment, toilet play, etc, etc. But first up, we have Peter. Enjoy. Hello and welcome to Betwixt the Sheets. I am tickled pink to have with me today Peter Tupper, who literally wrote the book on sadomasochism and its history. I'm so thrilled to have you here. Thank you so much.
Pleasure to be here, Kate.
The history of BDSM, the history of kink. This is fascinating and your work is fascinating. And I think what kind of attracts me to it is people often think that kink is new. Like it's a new thing that we've come up with. And that's definitely not true.
Not at all.
What's the earliest records that we have of what could be called kink?
Well, that's a complicated question because you look in the human history, you see many examples of people voluntarily undergoing painful experiences. But it's only relatively recently that we've seen what we would sort of recognize as kink today. So, for example, in Pompeii, the Roman city that was buried in the volcano, there's a house called the Villa of the Mysteries, and it includes a mural on one of the walls, which includes a case of a woman using a cane or switch to beat another woman. And in the next segment of the panel, we see the woman being beaten dancing ecstatically. So we see all kinds of experiences like this. And this is part of Christianity as well, because we had this whole tradition of mortification of the flesh, of imitation of Christ in being...
God, I hadn't even thought of it like that before. But yeah, absolutely.
And there's a long, long tradition, and we find this in many cultures around the world, of overloading the senses to reach an altered state of consciousness. And this was part of Christianity as well, of self-flagellation, of wearing hair shirts or cilices, which are these little sort of studded bands that go around the thigh. Now, this was always a controversial point within Christianity. And people would, for example, there was a great deal of controversy over these Christian populist movements, which included flagellation as part of their practices, and to the point where the Pope had to ban flagellation by lay people. So this was never officially part of Christian practice, and it was sort of gradually pushed out of religious practice. And this is around the same time that we started seeing it turn up in secular contexts. So if we look at 1503, there was an astrology treatise by a man named Pico della Mirandola. And this was sort of possibly the first description of voluntary flagellation in a purely secular context. He was explained it in terms of not religious suffering, but in terms of physiology. The belief was that older men were colder than young men and needed more stimulus to achieve erection and ejaculation. But that was an interesting, because also it was possibly the earliest known in the record. And as we go over the centuries in England and France, we find these little references to erotic flagellation. It turns up in plays. It turns up in sort of what you might call low-class literature. We find it in records about brothels, all about, until it turns up in Fanny Hill, the classic erotic novel. So it gets very interesting. And so as it sort of like got squeezed out of religion, it became part of the sexual world. And there's plenty of evidence that there were erotic flagellants throughout history. And so you get to the 19th century, there were brothels in England that specialized in what they called the English vice, which I'm not entirely sure is deserving title.
But we did seem to have a thing for it. Like, I mean, I'm going to, like, obviously this is a kink around the world and people from all walks of life enjoy a bit of slap and tickle. But why was it called the English vice? What were we doing? Well, we were spanking ourselves, but where did that come from?
Well, I believe it was actually began in France because, you know, Englishmen would come on their grand tour of the continent and they would visit brothels and they would request flagellation. And as a stereotype of the literature of the time, the depraved, perverse Englishman was a stock figure in French literature. I mean, the French certainly produced their own erotic literature of this kind. Jean-Jacques Rousseau.
He loved it, didn't he? Tell me about Jean-Jacques Rousseau.
In his autobiographical confessions, he talked about how, as a young man, he was infatuated with Mademoiselle Lambercier and how she would switch him as a young man. And, oh, you got Rachilde in the 20th century. You have the story of O. Everybody has this habit of projecting sexual perversity onto other cultures. So for the French, it was the English. For the English, it was the French. But there was definitely, I believe, by the 19th century, there was like an underground of people who engaged in what was just being called sadomasochism. The term itself, like sadism, was known for a while. That's obviously the Marquis de Sade, who definitely should not be left out in the annals of kink, France's contribution. But masochism was based on Leopold von Sacher-Masoch, who was an Austrian writer who wrote novels of men being dominated by women. And it was a scientist, Richard von Krafft-Ebing, who coined the term masochism and combined it with sadism to produce sadomasochism. And in his book, Psychopathia Sexualis, and I believe that was 1886. And he was the guy who wrote about his informants telling him about this basically pan-European underground brothels, newspaper advertisements, connecting kinky people across Europe. And that was kind of the seedbed of what eventually became the kink culture as we know it.
I mean, that's incredible, isn't it? Because one of the things that I'm always curious in is, how did people meet up? I mean, now, you know, that there are websites and there are apps and like it's much more openly spoken about. But if you were somebody who just loved spanking in the 19th century, like, how would you know where to go?
Well, the newspaper advertisements, there were classified ads and...
Really? They can't possibly have said, want to spank you. Like, what did they say?
They would use, like, you know, regarding discipline or, you know, coded language like that. There's an interesting story that there's an English magazine published in the 1870s called English Women's Domestic Magazine. It was published by Sam Beaton, who was the husband of Mrs. Beaton, who was sort of the Martha Stewart of her day.
Mrs. Beaton, yes. Mrs. Beaton's Household Works, yes.
Yes. And after her death, there was a strange period when the magazine had a letters section, which was full of flagellant people talking about flagellation and forced cross-dressing and things like this. So discussions of whether the treatment of children in schools and in the home, that was an incredibly controversial point in this. And this sort of spilled over into this fantasy letters, and people would write in saying is, you know, dear sir, I am writing in to you from, you know, the county of H blank. You know, we operate a small firm where young ladies are raised under proper discipline and judiciously applied corporal punishment and, you know, sincerely, H. And so they would always say, you know, somewhere in Sussex or something like that. And so this went on, you know, and we can find sort of a lineage of this type of writing going at least until it was still going on in the 1920s in London Life magazine.
I just feel like I'm just going to have to just sit with a minute to digest the fact that Mrs. Beaton's husband,
yeah,
his magazine facilitated effectively kinky readers' wives' letters.
Yes.
That's just blown my tiny brain.
There's so many bizarre connections in the world of kink. It's like if you discover like some sort of Narnia-like closet that opens up into like little hidden portals all through your city, and you can just like squeeze through this little portal when you're in a completely different building.
Speaking of Narnia, C.S. Lewis was a fan, wasn't he?
I actually don't know about C.S. Lewis. I do know that some interesting people turn up, like the Australian composer Percy Grainger, T.E. Lawrence.
Yes.
In later years of his life, he would write letters claiming to be from an uncle of his to his friends, instructing them on how he was to be beaten. And that's just the people we know about. Like, one of the centerpieces of my book is the exploration of the relationship of Arthur Munby and Hannah Colwick.
Tell me about them. They sound fascinating.
Well, Munby was a gentleman and a man of minor poet in the 19th century London. He was fascinated by working class women, and he loved to walk around the streets of London and Sheffield and interview them about their lives and have his photograph taken with them and things like that. And one day he met Hannah Colwick, who was a maid of all work, and she fit his type perfectly. And he was fascinated by women, especially large, strong women. And so they formed a secret master-slave relationship. She would wear a locking chain collar. She wore a leather wrist strap. And because they couldn't go on dates, they could not be seen together in public, she would write journal entries to him about her work as a maid of all work in a household, describing like her 16-hour workday. They would even arrange so that like she would be outside scrubbing flagstones and he would be like standing across the street watching her, even as like people would literally step over her, because she was like that far down the social hierarchy. And eventually they lived together. She was his maid of all work, and they were secretly married. And there would be moments when they would be alone together. She would hold him on her lap and lift him and pick him up and carry him around the rooms. There was very much what we would today call an age play element of her as this sort of nurturing nurse figure, because so many men back then of Munby status were more or less raised by their nurses and nannies, not their actual mothers, you know, and so he was just far more emotionally connected to this woman. And we have a great deal of detail about their relationship because they both kept detailed diaries that were bequeathed to Trinity College after his death. It was an interesting relationship because even though she proudly called herself his drudge and slave, she even called him Massa out of her Shropshire dialect. She was a very independent woman. She made sure that she was paid wages even when she was his wife. She made sure she always had enough money saved up to live on. So in a way, she was a very independent person who chose to live this life with this man. And it's only kind of a fluke that we have this reference to work with because Munby seriously considered burning all of his records. But he left it to Trinity College. It was sitting in a box for, I believe, something like 40 years and not even opened until the 50s. So there's so many things we don't know about that were just lost to history and became just part of people's private.
Like, this was in the 19th century.
Yes, they met in 1854.
This was in the 19th century.
Yes, this was when slavery was still a real thing in America.
Was there any sense from the diaries that other people knew about their lifestyle, or was it just them?
It was very private. Like, only Munby's closest friends knew about this relationship, and they didn't say anything. So they lived it in secret. It's an amazing look into these very private lives. You know, the other main source for this period is texts like Krafft Ebing's Psychopathia Sexualis and his case studies of people who were, you know, with all kinds of different fetishes. And plus, we have, of course, records of the pornography of the period. That was a whole list. So there was a underground of that, and that extended into the post-war era. That's when you started getting people like John Willey, who was a Australian, I believe. His name was John Coutts, but he went by John Willey. He was publishing Bizarre magazine, more or less out of his own pocket.
Oh, right.
And making these beautiful drawings of women in bondage or in bizarre costumes. And you started having, like Betty Page, for example, she was made famous for the bondage photography. That came out of Irving and Paula Claw. They were a brother and sister team who were running a movie star news, which was sold movie stills, and they noticed there were men coming in all the time looking for, you know, women in peril, damsel in distress type pictures of women in bondage from mainstream movies. And they realized there was a market here for making their own bondage photographs, short films, and drawings. So that was when you started getting those black and white pictures of Betty Page and other models from the time doing, you know, these kind of little too silly to be scary dress up in bondage and spanking. And that's also when you started seeing the artists like Eric Stanton and Jean Bilbrew coming out. One of the big problems we have in this field is that prior to about 1970, we know almost nothing about the heterosexual kink world.
What happened in 1970?
Around 1970, that's when Pat Bond and Terry Kolb started what would eventually become the Eulenspiegel Society in New York.
And what was the Eulenspiegel Society?
It was the first above-ground modern kink organization. They put an ad out asking about masochists lib.
Masochists lib? Oh my God, it's amazing.
This was only a couple years after Stonewall. And that was followed by the Eulenspiegel Society in San Francisco. That was about 74, 75. And that was sort of the prototype of kink organizations for heterosexual and bi people after that. And that's when we start getting records, start seeing everything before that. It's unfortunately very just sort of private people meeting through personal ads or other connections. So we just don't have a lot of material to work
with. Just don't have it.
And what about the Eulenspiegel Society was for straight people and bi people. Was the sense of like a lesbian BDSM scene?
Yeah, that's a similar problem is that like the earliest print evidence of a lesbian SM only goes back to about 1974. And it was mentioned sort of casually in a magazine, but it was called Hypatia. And again, unfortunately, we just don't have any evidence before that in the historical record. Like maybe somebody's journal or a scrapbook is sitting in an attic somewhere. I hope someday that something like that will turn up. I try to confine myself to the evidence as much as possible. Like I have data points and sometimes the distance between those data points is very large. But yes, the lesbian SM followed its own sort of parallel culture, like groups branched off from Society of Janus, one of which eventually became the Samwa Collective. And they published a number of works for lesbian SM. Like, lesbian SM is a detailed topic all in itself, and lots of controversies and internal politics of the lesbian community. But over the 80s, we had a growing number of organizations throughout North America about, you know, ultimate sort of derived from the Eulenspiegel Society model, TESS as they call it, you know, all over North America, and I'm presuming in Europe as well. And once the internet hit in the early 90s, which is sort of when I got started in the kink world, that's when it really switched into the next level, because there was this medium where people could meet according to interests anonymously, regardless of location.
I mean, just to go back to the, before we get on to the internet and what that managed to do, I was reading in your book that there was, that BDSM among the lesbian community actually became quite political, that there was, like, it kind of like a weird, like, you're either pro-BDSM or you're not pro-BDSM, or it's, and it became about a lot more than just
sexual desire.
It became very polarizing within the lesbian feminist community, and that came up to a head in 1982 in the Barnard Conference, which was a lesbian conference at Barnard College, and a number of anti-SM lesbian feminists were literally picketing outside the conference and protesting, even though, like, SM was just one of many topics being discussed at the conference. And this sort of epitomized the polarization of what was called the lesbian sex wars. And there are a couple of anthologies, like Against Sadomasochism and Feminism Unleashed, I believe, which were explicitly anti-SM. But also at the same time, there were the other path, when you got magazines like On Our Backs and, you know, Coming to Power, the anthology published by the Samwa Collective. So, you know, and that lasted into the 80s. Third wave feminism kind of was much more relaxed about sexual issues and open to SM qualities. So, yeah, there's a whole path. Like, there's kind of three cultures. There's, you know, the gay male culture that goes back to the 40s. Then, starting in the 1970s, you had the above ground heterosexual culture. And then, sort of as a branch off of that, you have the lesbian. And they sort of parallel each other in many respects, and the cross pollination, because gay leathermen were the most experienced and the two biggest sources of knowledge that the heterosexuals and lesbians could draw on were gay leathermen and prodoms. And there was a crossover there. That's the rise of AIDS sort of created a stronger divide between the straight and gay leather cultures. And then, you know, things have moved along since then. So we've had the post-internet generation is a very different beast in many respects. I mean, I've been around long enough that I was involved starting in the early 90s. So I've seen sort of new generations. I've gone from being the youngest person in the room to the oldest person. So there's new people these days. For example, Japanese-inspired rope bondage is extremely popular. And there are some people in the kink world who that is their sole interest, and they don't really mix with other forms of SM play. And, you know, that's how it goes. You know, and I enjoy seeing the spread and diversification. I'm glad to see that. I've been involved in the organizing in my own community for some time. I've seen a lot of changes, like, you know, the visibility of trans people and genderqueer people, the visibility of non-white people, BIPOC people. I'm trying to be an elder statesman of the field.
Yeah, absolutely. The guardian of knowledge. I suppose one of the things that we'll have to talk about is the big grey elephant in the room. What did 50 Shades of Grey and the fact that that became like a global juggernaut smash do to the kink scene? Because I've heard mixed things. I've heard some people who are involved in the kink community saying that it misrepresents them horrendously and they're very angry about it.
It does.
And then there's other people that say, but we are talking about it and it's made it mainstream, yeah, which is good.
Nobody is born within the kink scene. Everybody comes into it through various means. There are people who came into it, you know, their first exposure was Story of O, or some magazine they found in their dad's shed, or Anne Rice's beauty books, or Secretary back in 2002. So we cannot control what becomes our ambassador. we can only accept, you know, see people coming in and try to educate them and help them understand and hopefully, you know, understand the importance of consent and negotiation and learning from those who have gone before. I also think that my big concern is that media like 50 Shades and like Secretary, they make it acceptable for a very white, very upper middle class, very heteronormative relationship to be kinky. It still draws this line between that and queer SM, SM that is, say, male submissive, female dominant. That's my concern. So I'm hoping that what something like 50 Shades does is that it starts a conversation. Like, one of the things I am glad to see is that so many mainstream articles about 50 Shades have accepted the idea that it does not model good consent practices. And I think that's a positive step that so many people in the mainstream understand that.
Absolutely. And, you know, I would love to stay talking to you about this forever, but I'm going to have to wrap this up. And I suppose a good place to finish it would be, Peter, what do you think is the future of BDSM and what would you like to see? I mean, we've seen it go more mainstream. We've seen conversations take place. But what would you like to see going forward?
I'd like to see it have a degree of legal protection. I would like to have law enforcement understand ideas of consent, but also understand that some people have tried to use SM to cover up abuse, like here in Canada, the Jian Gomeshi case. That's why I think groups like the National Coalition for Sexual Freedom are doing very good work. I'd like to see more diverse people, non-white people bring in ideas. I'd like to see younger people bring in ideas. I think that I want to see it become more diverse, more inclusive, and address the problems. It has so much to offer the world.
Thank you so much, Peter. And if people want to read more about your research and find you online, where can they do that?
I blog at historyofbdsm.com, and I'm working on my next book, which is about kink in mainstream media, called The Celluloid Dungeon. So please look me up there, and I've also got the usual mailing list and other. I've had some problems getting kicked off platforms like Tumblr, so I've had to switch to a mailing list. And I hope to have a new book in a few years.
And your book is The Lover's Pinch, is the history of sadomasochism?
A Lover's Pinch, A Cultural History of Sadomasochism, which is a Shakespeare quote, always classy.
I love it. Thank you so much for joining me today, Peter. You've been an absolute treat to talk to.
Thank you, Kate.
I'll be back after this short break with professional dominatrix Miss May Berlin and her sub, Frankie. You do not want to miss this chat.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
So hello and welcome. Thank you so much for joining me betwixt the sheets. I am talking to Miss May and to Frankie. Hello.
Hi. How are you?
I'm ridiculously excited to be talking to you two. Miss May, you are a professional dominatrix.
That's right.
And Frankie, you are Miss May's sub. Have I got that right?
Sub and boyfriend.
Sub, boyfriend. Would the word owned be appropriate,
yeah,
or not?
I have a collar.
Okay.
But it's on video, so you can't see. So.
I can see it, and it's a very, very nice collar indeed. I'm so pleased that you're here talking to me today. And one of the things that I really want to do is try and dispel some of the myths and the stigmas and the prejudice that surround BDSM and kink. And obviously, this has a history as long as humans have been able to do kinky stuff. Of course it does.
That's right, yeah.
But it's not very openly talked about. So I'm so grateful that you guys are here. Perhaps you can tell me a little bit about how you met.
Yeah, so Frankie used to come and see me
for sessions. And then we just decided that we really get on very well outside of the sessions. And we got together. And well, since then, we've been just doing normal couple stuff, but also been really involved in the kink scene together, doing photo shoots and expanding our kink life together as partners and own slave and mistress.
Is that difficult to negotiate? Because I can understand if Frankie's coming to you for sessions, that's like a sort of a closed space of this is the dynamic. But then when it's a full-time relationship, can you kind of slip out of those roles and back into them? How does that work for you guys?
For sure, it slips out. Right now, we will not live in the same country. So we kind of make the time to see each other, where we spend intense time together, where we do some play and also normal, let's say, vanilla things, where we are also like in regular relationship. So that's actually easy to manage. We just have our play times like any other people would have sex. We just do sex and kinky things together. Yeah. What do you think, Frankie?
Yeah, I think like the kind of dom sub dynamic sort of hums along in the background, like comes to the forefront or recedes depending on the context. So like we could just be doing normal vanilla couple stuff or whatever, and then Miss May will be like, go lie down in the bath and I'm gonna do this to you or something like that. So it's, but like it's just kind of, well, I don't know how explicit we can be.
Yeah. Or you be as explicit as you want, absolutely.
Okay, right. So we were like watching stupid YouTube videos, and Miss May was like, "Oh, lie down in the bath. I'm going to piss on you."
And waterboard you.
And waterboard you with my piss. But then after that, we went for brunch or something. So like, it just kind of sits in the background and then comes to the forefront or recedes depending on the context. Like, I'm in Berlin at the moment, and when I came here, my flight was really late because it got delayed overnight, so I was really tired. So like, we didn't do like lots of play and stuff when I arrived.
I have to be also very considerate of his safety and well-being. Obviously, I wouldn't force him into do things where he would be uncomfortable. But when we feel like we're recharged and rested, we tend to play a bit more extreme as well. And if, let's say, if we're both tired or something, we do less things that are exhausting, because some types of play can be exhausting mentally and physically. So
I think you've touched on something really important there, which is that being conscious and aware of the boundaries and what your partner is willing to do. Consent. There's this sort of idea that BDSM is just knocking each other about, but the level of conversation and consent that goes into it is considerable.
Yes, exactly. I mean, let's say when I'm playing with my partner, which is Frankie, I always check in on him, but I know that I always respect his boundaries, but I push, how do I always say it? I push the boundaries and I...
Limits.
Oh, yeah. I respect the limits, but push the boundaries, or the other way around. I don't know anymore. Sorry, I always translate from German to English. But for example, when I'm in my professional life and I at work, I always have a chat before the session with my submissives, where we discuss everything, and I always make them aware that if there is something that they, especially first sessions, where, because if someone's irregular, you kind of know each other and you kind of know how you take. But if it's like someone I just met, I always say, you always can say no. I always use code words like amber and red, or different code words where if they are restricted, if I'm doing a heavy rubber session, or let's say his mouth and hands are tied up, then we do different code words, which is more physical. But yeah, like consent is key in BDSM, and people most of the time respect that. I don't know how it is at parties, but in a professional way, for sure.
For sure. I mean, that's really important, especially when you're dealing with something that I suppose could potentially be dangerous, or if you're experimenting with pain play, it's very important to have those boundaries, isn't it?
Yeah, that's for sure. I mean, there is so much that can go wrong if you go to someone who's not experienced or less professional. I mean, I have heard that, I mean, I even had people tell me, oh, I went to this and this person and just wasn't safe, or non-consensual things happen. And it's so dangerous, especially if someone's new and advertising their work and they think they can be a professional dominatrix, but they actually don't understand certain things. It can just be really dangerous. So it's very, very important if you do go to someone professional that they have knowledge what they're doing.
That's so important to say. And so how did you guys get into this lifestyle? How did you, was this just something that you've always been aware of, that this was like...
Yeah, I grew up in Berlin. So BDSM, I mean, Berlin is a very kinky city. So BDSM has always been a part of my life. And whether it's been like raves or anything. But I always wanted to experience everything possible in life and as extreme. And I think BDSM drew me to it because BDSM pushes you into extreme, which I always crave in life. And I like intense experiences. But BDSM was always a part of my life since I was 18. But I really got into like the kink scene. I got more involved and much more active at the age of 21. I just really wanted to go to parties. And before that, in my previous relationship, I wasn't able to live out my sexual fantasies and my kinky fantasies as much as I did in my last recent relationship. So yeah, just that. I think it takes a good partner and a partner who's kinky to get into kink and the BDSM thing. Yeah. What do you think, Frankie?
I've only ever like fantasized about kinky sex and stuff.
As long as you can remember, that's been your thing.
Yeah, definitely. Wow. Like, it's weird also, it's sort of pre-puberty as well. I don't know, like you have like memories of kind of, I guess like films where people were wearing leather or were tied up or something. And you, I don't know, I've only ever kind of fantasized about it. But I was quite ashamed about it for a long time. You know, thought it was like a sign of trauma or whatever, like kind of those stereotypes. And then it was just kind of in the lockdown, we were talking about lockdown prompting people to get more into BDSM. I kind of thought about it more and like I saw a few interviews of people kind of in the scene talking about it. And, you know, I was like, oh, this is just normal and it's fine. And these people are cool and interesting and healthy. I was like, I don't know why I was so worried. So I just kind of took the leap and started going to events and stuff. And obviously I saw May professionally.
And has it always been the submissive role that you've been attracted to? And Miss May, has it always been the dominant role, or have you ever switched?
For me, I have been submissive in my previous relationship where I wasn't really exploring my dominant side. Only professionally I was living it out. And it was very funny because I was always submissive, but I think as a woman, we think, because of how the life works and everything, we always think that as women have to be submissive and that's our part. And we kind of are pushed into being submissive, but I've realized that I'm not. And then when I was at work, I remember the session with Frankie very vividly that it turned me on. And it was the first time that like I got turned on at work and I was like, oh, that's weird. But then afterwards, when we then hung out and met and talked, I've realized, oh, that's actually a part of my sexuality. And I just basically switch from being submissive to being dominant. I mean, I've tried dominant things before and there are some things that I still like that would be considered submissive. Like I like spanking and I like drinking piss, which we do together always, like piss play. But I wouldn't say I have a submissive dynamic with Frankie. He is my submissive and I'm the dominant.
You can do those like activities
without being submissive or dominant. Yeah,
so you can do the traditionally submissive activity in a way that is, you're still in the sort of dominant role.
I feel like people always want to push people in brackets, like, oh, if you are dominant you have to do these certain things, if you are submissive you have to do these certain things. I even heard from my, because I recorded videos before with another dom where I was submissive because she was teaching me everything, that's how I got there. And one of my clients was like, oh, I saw actually you were submissive with another mistress. Well, I don't like that. And I'm like, I can do whatever I want. Just because I'm letting a mistress spank me, that doesn't mean I'm a less of a dominant. That just means I have a good understanding how the submissive is feeling. And that's what a lot of people forget. But I feel it's just the older generation and my older clients who think that, because the new people are like, oh, that's amazing what you do. And this is cool. And this is cool. So, yeah.
I like that there's a certain sort of fluidity to it, like it's more of like an energy that's being played with than actual rigid roles that are at work.
Yeah.
So you've mentioned there that like the sort of the older BDSM scene, do you feel that there has been a change in the current BDSM change? Are things...
So I always talk with my clients about it because there's sometimes certain kinks where like aren't very common or like strange. And what all my clients always say, people haven't been that open about things back in the days. People back in the days, they've been much more closed off. They weren't talking about kinks. There was a shame. There's a stigma around kink and kinky things. Where now you have, for example, all the big techno clubs which have dark rooms like Berghain in Berlin. I mean, there are so many sex clubs. And now in London where you see Club Forbotten, Crossbreed or One Night Parties. And I think there's one called Slut Social. Like, there is much more kink parties and people are just much more open about their sexualities. And also social media. nowadays people can connect with each other so easily, and there is Fet Life, there's, you know, kinky people on Instagram everywhere. You can just go online and find people who are into the certain things. Back in the days, it didn't exist. There was mags. I collect some vintage fetish mags. You would have magazines where there would be, I'm seeking this and this, you know, where now you have kinky dating apps. So it's much, much, much more easier to connect with people.
And I suppose it's sort of revolutionized everything, hasn't it? And it's made it much more accessible. But then I suppose part of that...
Yeah, which I think is
mostly good.
But
then it's also like, if people don't quite know what they're doing, that can be an issue, can't it? I was thinking more like people that would want to explore submissive, but they might encounter what you've just described as a fake dom. But that's back to the consent and conversations, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, whenever you play with someone, vet them. As a submissive, especially vet your dom. Vetting and just checking up, seeing if people know them, that's very important, because abuse of power is a big thing and people will abuse their positions. You know, I just don't trust people. So always, always vet them, especially if you're playing. I mean, being submission is such a vulnerable thing and it shouldn't be given to everyone. What do you think about that, Frankie?
Yeah, no, I think it's true. I mean, one thing, although like a lot of stuff is more on dating apps and online now, it's still a very kind of in-person community. So for me, I kind of only met people, well, either through professionally or like going to events and stuff and talking to people. And there are these things called like munches, which are like kinky pub trips, basically. So like, I went to a few of those and that's how I like met my kinky friends. And we went to some of the bigger events like Club Verboten that Ms. May mentioned. But because of that, there is like, it can, you know, people do look out for each other a bit within that context.
Yeah.
So people have reputations. Or if you go to an event like Club Verboten, like if you go to one of the playrooms, there are always like monitors watching to make sure that no one's doing anything that's unsafe. And then obviously you can go to them if you see something that you think is not right. So no space is safe, I don't think, in my opinion. But like those are as safe as you can get in a club context.
And I think also like those parties like Club Verboten and Crossbeat, they always vet the people who are going there. They always check. And,
yeah, they've got like rules. They've got like 10 rules. And then when you're getting through the door, they'll say, can you name one of our rules? And their stuff like, don't assume people's genders or boundaries. If you see something that's not right, speak to one of the dungeon monitors or whatever. So they work really hard to try and make these places as safe as possible in terms of playing.
Wow. So I mean, that sort of level of communication and like holding space for people, that's really reassuring and impressive. And I know that you are a professional mistress, Miss May, which I could talk to you about that for weeks. I honestly could. But
please ask away.
Could you perhaps talk a little bit about some of the services that are on offer? Because kind of what I'm interested in is, are there changes in fashions? Are there like services that come into fashion that suddenly everyone seems to want?
To be honest, it all depends on the dominatrix you're contacting, because certain types of dom specialize in certain types of things. Recently, I've had a lot of requests for anal play. I went one weekend to Munich for work. I think I fisted 4 asses that weekend or something. But yeah, it all depends how you promote yourself. I was doing a lot of toilet play and a lot of piss play for sure. And I think, I mean, I would say like what in the kink scene, I think like piss got really commercialized recently. And I think like people who are also in the vanilla relationships, people have been much more into pegging, I guess, or they've always been, I don't know. I feel like pegging and piss have been like a big thing, but
I've heard more about pegging recently. I've definitely, like, even like jokes and stuff that you see kind of creeping in, and it's like, oh, so it's now part of the conversation in a way that it wasn't before.
And professionally, I think it all depends on what dominant you are, but yeah, for me it was anal play and toilet play, piss play. I do a lot of latex sessions as well. I'm really interested in heavy rubber, heavy bondage. There's something really interesting where like my submissives are totally restricted and they cannot move. And I work in a great studio in Berlin called Fetisch Institute.
Oh, go on, tell me your favorite. What's your favorite thing to play with?
Oh, we have this bondage chair, which is restricted from head to toe. Frankie has been in it. And there is a funnel inside.
There's a glint in his eye.
That basically you can put liquid in it. I piss usually in it. And the funnel goes into your mouth. And you're basically, your head is restricted, your neck, your legs, your arms, everything. You cannot move and you just have to force drink piss. Wow. You're laughing. You're like,
oh. That is just fun.
Yeah. I'm going to assume you have to work up to that, though. That sounds like quite an intimidating thing to someone that sort of, do you sort of start with a smaller chair and then work your way up?
Well, before I started, that's something I struggled. How do I initiate play? How do I put someone in a subspace and how do I start a play? And what I did was I always make them feel like that they're mine. And then the time once they're here, whilst we're playing, I do anything I want. Obviously, because we discussed consent before, they always can tap out, but I'm just telling them that they're mine and I'll do whatever I want and that they're my submissive. And, you know, and then I do those things that they allowed me to, and they're what they into and their likes and dislikes. So, yeah, it's fun.
Oh, that is a hell of a day at work. That is just to casually go, oh, I fisted four asses today and I pissed this.
It gets intense. I work quite a lot. I travel once a month to London and I travel once a month to Munich. I'm based in Berlin. However, from August, I'm going to be based in London. I'll be traveling to Berlin and Munich. But it can get quite intense, especially because in Munich, you just work the whole day and you see multiple submissives where, yeah, different sessions, different settings. It's not always easy.
And it must be quite draining for you as well to like be sort of control that space. And
it is, yes, because, you know, your clients depend on your safety. Depends what kind of play. Obviously, I don't do always heavy bondage or heavy things. I sometimes do also softer things like foot worship or, you know, but I always have to be aware of their safety and of their well-being, because at the end of the day, I am responsible for them. It gets very draining. I mean, emotionally, for sure, I always need aftercare for myself, which I do whilst talking to friends or talking to Frankie. I definitely am emotionally drained from this job.
Honestly, I could talk to you forever, but I am going to have to wrap this up. But this is something that I'm always interested in because I'm a sex historian, and that creates a bit of a situation when I'm introducing myself to people and they say, what work do you do? And I'm only a historian. How do you introduce yourself? Do you just say I'm a dominatrix, or as some sex workers do, they say I'm an accountant? How do you introduce yourself?
Well, I always check in what environment I am, because if I'm on a kinky party, I will say that I'm a dominatrix. If I'm carrying a slave on a dog lead, I will obviously say I'm a dominatrix, and if I'm in a kinky party. But let's say if we are in a vanilla environment and I just met the people, I always say I work in fashion, which is my background actually, and that's it. I don't really want to tell people my job straight away because there's still a lot of stigma and prejudice. People will assume things just because I'm a professional dominatrix, that I'm mean, that I'm rude, that I'm dominant, that I do this or that, but well, it is not just a job because I'm also a lifestyle dominatrix, but people also need to understand that I'm also a person outside of my dominant role. And I feel like a lot of people forget that when they hear about my job. Yeah,
absolutely. What do your friends and family, what's their response to this?
I mean, I was always kinky and telling my friends about it. It wasn't a surprise when I said I did this professionally. I told my parents only after like 4 months doing it professionally. And their reaction was, I come from a very Polish family, which are, I wouldn't say super Christian, but, you know, my parents are not super traditional, but it's different. We just grew up very Polish. And my parents were happy for me, which I was very surprised. And they said, as long as I'm happy and as long as I'm independent, they're happy for me. However, the reaction of my sister was much more different. My sister, I didn't get any support from her. She was just like, I can't believe you're doing this and stuff. And she was really upset. So it's always a mixed reaction. You obviously lose some friends and you gain some friends. But most of the people that I'm around with, they're also kinky. So I have a big support network of my friends.
I'm glad that you've got the support network there. And what about you, Frankie? Do your friends and family know about your kinky lifestyle and about being owned and submissive? Actually, it's not really a conversation you have with your parents. I mean, maybe it is. I don't know.
My parents don't. I think my mum knows I'm into like kinky things a bit, but I did not like the extent to which I am. I wouldn't tell my dad at all. And then my friends before I got into the kink scene or whatever are all like very supportive and were like, because I was a bit nervous at first, and they were like, yeah, just go for it. It's kind of, you know, you should just do what you want. And, you know, that's fine. So they were nice about it.
That's good to hear. And finally, Miss May, if people want to find out more about you or where you are, how can they look you up? And they should.
You can Google me, Miss May Berlin. I have an OnlyFans and a clip store. It's both with Miss May Berlin. Or you can find me on Instagram, Worship Miss May. And my Twitter is also Miss May Berlin, I think. Yeah, and also have a website called Miss May Berlin. So basically, you just have to Google Miss May Berlin and you'll find all the magic that you're looking for in your life. Or just curious. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much, guys. You have been an absolute treat to talk to. Thank you so much, Miss May and Frankie.
Thank you.
Thanks.
I hope you've enjoyed today's episode, and thank you so much to Peter, Miss May and Frankie for sharing their time, their knowledge, their expertise. You were all marvellous. This episode was produced by Charlotte Long and includes music by Epidemic Sound. If you like what you've heard, then please don't forget to like, review and subscribe. Feel free to check out some of our past episodes. I love the one on boob jobs, medieval sex and sexy shoes. In fact, you know, I love them all. But go and have a look. They're all in our back catalogue. We've also got episodes on drag queens and poppers coming your way, so you wouldn't want to miss that. Thank you for listening to this episode of Betwixt the Sheets. Please follow the show wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps us and you'll be doing us a big favour. Don't forget, you can also listen to all these podcasts ad-free and watch hundreds of documentaries when you subscribe at historyhit.com/subscribe. As a special gift, you can get your first 3 months for just £1 a month when you use the code BETWIXT at checkout.